You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is Monday, October 25th, 2010, and this afternoon on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from our archives, a conversation with Richard Russo, author of 8 books and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his novel Empire Falls. Richard Russo lives with his wife in Camden, Maine, and in Boston. His latest novel, published in 2009 by Knopf, is That Old Cape Magic. Bookended by 2 weddings, this novel begins with the character Jack Griffin on his way to Cape Cod for a wedding. In his trunk are his father's ashes, which he plans to scatter on the Cape, the place he spent his childhood summers and the place he and his wife honeymooned and planned for the future they now enjoy. But by the end of the weekend, the past has so totally swamped the present that by the next wedding, his own daughter's, a year later, with 2 urns in his trunk, Griffin is left wondering how it all came so swiftly unglued. I spoke to Richard Russo in August 2009 in anticipation of a visit that he was making to Vermont to speak at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. I asked him to talk about how he came to write That Old Cape Magic.
Well, this was, strangely enough, this happens from time to time. It hasn't happened in a while. This book began as a short story, and I had originally envisioned that it was going to be about this guy, Jack Griffin, who had who was driving onto the Cape a day before his wife, because they're headed to a wedding, but he wants to scatter his father's ashes. It was going to be a short story that was going to involve the amount of time it took for him to drive from Boston out to Provincetown, or Truro, okay, where he was going to scatter his father's ashes, and he would either do that or fail to do that. That was going to be the scope of the story. I didn't envision that they would even get to the wedding, that none of this other stuff was going to happen. But then, unexpectedly, his mother called him on his cell phone, and a seagull crapped on him, and suddenly we were off to the races, which was both good news and a little bit scary news, because the whole reason I wanted to write a short story and not begin another novel was that I was just so exhausted after completing Bridge of Sighs. It was my biggest and my most ambitious novel, and I just didn't think I had it in me to begin another book.
Right.
So I
right.
think this was just a way of the way we all fool ourselves at times into doing something that we don't think we can do. I think my subconscious just was telling me, okay, just start a nice, simple little short story. And so that's what I did at the conscious level, and then subconsciously I think I was being fed everything that I needed to begin a new book.
And was this book exhausting for you?
No, actually this book, you know, every book is requires a certain amount of birthing pain, but this one was far less, and I think it's because I didn't think of it as a novel really until I was 100 pages into it, and so that beautiful self-deception allowed me to get rocking and rolling on this book before I even knew what it was.
Right now. The book begins as Griffin, Jack Griffin, prepares to attend the wedding of his daughter's friend, and his mother calls. And in the section that follows, the reader learns a lot about Griffin's parents and their own failed marriage. I'm curious,
right,
why, once it became a book, did you decide to open the book in this way, with so much information about his parents' failed marriage?
Well, his parents are really at the center of this story.
Yeah.
I think this is a book about inheritance, and it's about Jack Griffin's kind of inability to accept his genetic inheritance.
Right.
I've just turned 60. The Griffins are just a couple years younger than I, and I think this book may strike a chord with at least people our age, in that I came into manhood during Vietnam, and
yeah,
it was a time at 17, 18, 19, 20, around in there, where my generation was saying to themselves, whistling past that graveyard, was saying to themselves, never trust anyone over 30, which we managed to believe for a full decade until we turned 30. And I think we believed that, as Jack believes in this book, that we could reinvent ourselves, that we did not have to accept our parents' legacy. We did not have to accept our parents' inheritance. That we could create new marriages and a new kind of marriage, and I think that's what Jack, in particular, far more so than his wife Joy, that's what Jack kind of signs on for, what they refer to early in their marriage as the Great Truro Accord.
Right, I love that,
which I'm very fond of. I think Jack, more than his wife, believes that they can create a new kind of marriage, which is based on a very simple philosophy, a plague on both their houses.
Right,
that is both his parents' house, their house of failed marriage. And I think he feels the same way about Joy's parents until he realizes, to his horror, that she actually loves her parents. And while she has no illusions, she doesn't want exactly the kind of marriage that her parents had. Nevertheless, her love for them does not permit her to say a plague upon my parents' house. And so they find themselves now, years later, one of them willing to accept the parental legacy and inheritance, and the other unwilling to do so. And so they have been in a way in conflict all along, but it's only now
right.
It's only now becoming crucial.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's why we spend that long second chapter backtracking into Griffin's parents' marriage, because they do, even as he's tried to keep them out of his own marriage, they've been there right from the start, and
yeah.
they aren't going anywhere.
Right, right. Maybe this would be a good time for you to read from that old Cape Magic.
Okay. The rugged Maine coastline was stunning, Griffin had to admit. The light so pure it almost hurt. He couldn't help wondering what would have happened if his parents had fallen in love with this part of the world instead of the Cape. Certainly it would have been more affordable, but that begged an obvious question. Would they really have wanted something they could afford? After all, much of the Cape's allure was its shimmering elusiveness, the magical way it receded before them year after year, the stuff of dreams. Coastal Maine, by contrast, seemed not just real but battered by reality. Where Cape Cod somehow managed to give the impression that July lasted all year, Maine reminded you that even in lush late spring, of its long, harsh winters of snowdrifts that rotted baseboards and splintered latticework, of relentless winds that howled in the eaves and scoured the paint, leaving gutters rusted white with salt. Even the people looked scoured, or so it seemed to Griffin, as he drove down the peninsula toward the Hedges, the resort hotel where Laura's wedding would take place tomorrow. Wouldn't have it as a gift, his mother informed him in answer to his unspoken question.
Thank you very much. Another thing I loved in this book was the use of the categories can't afford it and wouldn't have it as a gift. I thought those were really fun.
Yeah, I mean that's and his parents who have not had a happy marriage. I think part of the reason that they were not destined for happiness is that if you go through life with those two categories informing just about every place you go and everything you do, if it all falls into the categories of can't afford it and wouldn't have it as a gift, I don't think you're destined for happiness, are you?
No, I don't think so. Although I do think that there's something about the Cape that does lend itself to those two categories.
Yeah, the Cape. I think the Cape, the islands, Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard. We started taking our daughters to Martha's Vineyard when they were just little girls. We were living in the Midwest at the time.
Oh, yeah. which we can't describe on the radio.
We can't describe what kind of Midwest that is, but the book does.
Yeah.
And so we took our children to this magical place, and my wife and I did, as Griffin's parents do, look at the real estate guide for the Cape and the Islands every time we came east for a week or two of vacation.
Yeah.
And it did have that elusive quality, because every year, and especially as I started publishing books, and I wasn't just looking to hopefully to be as a college professor promoted or tenured or anything like that and be doing a little bit better financially. But even after I started publishing books, I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be the year we're going to come back and we're going to see something on the Cape or on Martha's Vineyard that we'll be able to afford. Won't that be great? And then every year it took us about 5 minutes looking at the real estate guide to realize that if we had done well that year, that Martha's Vineyard had done even better, and prices of everything had not only matched any gains that we had made, but probably far exceeded them. And so the island and the Cape just receded before us at almost exactly the pace that we were moving toward it. It was moving away.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that is the stuff of dreams. I think that's especially now that we, as Americans, we no longer work for General Electric throughout a lifetime, as my mother did. We no longer work for General Motors over a lifetime. We no longer have a sense of being in a place, doing a kind of work that is going to define our lives. We're on the move now, and I think that notion of a finer place, which was part of what I was after in this book, that ever-receding finer place, magical place, it's a fool's errand, probably, but boy, we love to do it. We love to chase it. We're dreamers in America, and we love to chase dreams.
And I think we're pretty specific about what we dream about. I mean, the Cape is a world apart from the Jersey Shore, and that's apart from the Hamptons, and that's apart from the Adirondacks, and whatever you grew up with, that's what you're going to fantasize about.
I think so. Yeah. And so we're looking, even as we're looking forward, we're also looking backward.
I
think that's true. Particularly for Joy in this book, whose dreams are slightly different from her husband's. Even as Joy is looking forward into the future, the kind of house that she wants to have for herself and for Jack and for their children when it comes time to have children, the house that she's looking at in the future is very much a replica of the house that she grew up with, mm-hmm. that she grew up in as a child, and one that her parents vacationed in on the coast of Maine. So that's something else that we do paradoxically, I think, as Americans, is that we're always trying to look well into the future with fairly specific dreams that are located, I think, in the past, almost always.
Right, that's so funny, isn't it? I'm going to do it so much better than my parents, but I'd like what they had, please.
Yes, yes. What they have, plus the internet and our iTunes.
Right.
Yes.
I think, and so do a lot of your critics, that one of your great strengths is writing fiction that feels very real and sometimes quite sad, but also always infused with humor. And I'm wondering if you can talk about mixing humor into your fiction. How easily does that come to you?
Well, I think I have a comic view of the world just by nature, and it's difficult for me to write any other way. I don't know exactly how it is that humor creeps in, but I find it's almost impossible for me to write a page of fiction without jokes in it, but I will say without that way of taking one step back from my characters and seeing what's funny about them, even when they can't see it in themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's partly an artistic stance, I think. I recognized it as a young writer rereading Steinbeck one day, his novel Cannery Row, and he has this wonderful, it's the introduction to a chapter in which he says of the madam in a whorehouse, he says, Dora Flood was a great woman. And then the next phrase is, a great big woman. with a taste for Nile green evening dresses. Now, that's a stance. That's an authorial stance where you begin talking about a character and you say that she is a great woman, and the reader says to us, oh, that's a value judgment, you know, and what exactly is Dora Flood's greatness? And then the next phrase undermines that completely, because great now doesn't, now it modifies another adjective, a great big woman, which says something about Dora Flood. The author says something about Dora Flood, and it is inherently comic.
Yeah,
and I remember reading that sentence and thinking, "Oh, okay, all right. That's how this works. You have a kind of authorial attitude when you sit down to write about your characters. It's not unkind, but it is a step removed from the way they would think about themselves. That's not the way Dora Flood thinks about herself.
Right.
This is the way John Steinbeck thinks about Dora.
Yes.
And it's funny. It's not unkind." But it is, it's a comic worldview, isn't it?
Yeah, and I do think that it probably is that author's worldview that makes that possible, as opposed to being able to work toward humor, which I think, you know, doesn't it sort of have to just come naturally?
I think so. I mean, back when I was teaching fiction writing to students, and sometimes my graduate students in particular would say, how do you make things funny? And I would say, well, I don't think I'm making anything funny. I'm simply reporting the world to you as I see it.
Right. Yeah.
And so I think that's, which is just to beg the question, I say, where, when you say, how do things get funny, in a way I kind of explain something to you that's ultimately a non-explanation. It resides in my character somewhere. It resides in just naturally the way I look at things, which is just, you know, to rephrase your question, actually, as much as it is to answer it.
Sure. Well, no, it does, though. I'm curious, as you're working, are you revising as you go, or do you write a full first draft before even letting yourself look back?
Typically what happens is that I write, you know, first of all, I write in longhand in the morning, and my first revision is when I type what I wrote in the morning onto my onto disk in the afternoon. So there's a little bit of revision in that, but more to the point, I think what happens is that I write about 75 pages usually, or 100 pages, and at that point I realize that I've either made a mistake that forces me to go back, because you don't want to keep building on a mistake. At that point, I've usually made either a mistake, or I suddenly write a sentence and I say to myself, oh, wait a second, this is the first sentence of the book.
Hmm.
Which means that which is not exactly a mistake. It just means that, okay, if this is the first sentence of the book, then I have to go back and recast things. And sometimes I will, you know, 150, 200 pages into a book, introduce a character who I think is, oh, wait a second, that character has to be there in the first chapter, and I'll go back. And so all of those things are revisions. Probably the most important kind of revision there is, realizing that you've not begun in the right place, or you've not, a character that you didn't envision being in the book has to be there right from the start. Those kinds of things. So by the time you get to the final stretch of the novel, the home stretch, Act Three, whatever that is, then I write straight through to the end, because I want to find out how the story ends. And by then, you've walked through so many doors, and so many narrative doors have kind of closed behind you, that need to go back and start again, to revise, to get to know where your true beginning is. Those issues have by then usually resolved themselves.
Now, when you find that there's a new character on page 150 that really should have been in at the beginning, do you go, oh, shoot, or are you excited to make those changes?
Yeah, you do. Part of you is saying, oh, no, you know, I gotta go back and work this in from the beginning. But then another part of you is saying, okay, all right, this makes the book richer and truer.
Right.
And I think we all novelists feel that part of the novelist's trade, part of what we do, is to keep as many balls in the air, as many narrative balls in the air at one time as possible. We are jugglers far more than poets and short story writers and artists who work in shorter forms. They don't have to be jugglers in quite the way that a novelist is, or even a screenwriter is. Those are forms. They're longer forms, and they require you to do everything at once.
Right. Did you have any idea ahead of time that you were going to win the Pulitzer Prize for Empire Falls, or did that call
no.
come? That was a total surprise when they make that phone call.
As big a surprise as I'm going to get. I mean, that particular year, number one, there were an awful lot of good books, as there are most years. I thought there were a good 2-3 dozen books that could have won the prize that year, and probably nobody would have had any complaints.
Right.
So there were a lot of books, and the Pulitzer is always the one that comes out last. And so all the other major awards, the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, the Penn Faulkner Award, even the Penn New England Award, the shortlists, I hadn't made the shortlist for any of those awards that year. So I had no rational reason to believe that I was not only going to win the Pulitzer, but even be shortlisted for it was beyond what I was thinking at that time. So no, that was a total surprise, not only to me, but to my publisher, to my editor. I think everybody was... I think at the beginning of the whole process that they thought that this was a book that was going to get awards consideration, but then, you know, as the major awards kind of slipped by, I think we had all started looking forward to the next novel.
So it came
as pretty much a surprise to all of us, I think.
What a fabulous surprise. Did you go to the Cape?
Indeed.
Did you go to the Cape that weekend?
Actually, I learned of the prize that day, and the very next day my wife and I were on a plane to Spain, because my Spanish publisher was bringing the book out that day. So you know, a lot of the things that a writer would do after winning a Pulitzer Prize, you know, in the way of publicity and going on, you know, going on talk shows and doing another round of publicity and all of that, I didn't really get to do any of that, because I would have had to postpone my, and that wouldn't have been fair to my Spanish publisher. So we hopped on a plane, and that's something about literary fame, actually, is we were in Spain for a few days, and we had tacked on a couple of days in Venice. I was writing Bridge of Sighs then.
Uh-huh.
We had tacked on a couple of days in Venice, so we were gone for just about a week. And by the time we got back, it was all over. You know, all of the phone had stopped ringing, and such is literary fame. You know, we'd moved on.
Now, I know that you're also a screenwriter, and you've written the screenplays for at least 3 of your own works. Is that right?
Well, not produced works, but yeah, I wrote the screenplay for Empire Falls, of course, and I did script doctor work on Nobody's Fool.
Okay.
And I wrote a screenplay for Straight Man, which went through something like 20 drafts before it finally went into turnaround, the way these things do.
Uh-huh.
And I've written original screenplays, and I've adapted other writers' work for the screen as well.
And now, this is sort of a little tangential question, but Paul Newman has been in a number of the movies that came out of books and screenplays that you wrote.
Yeah.
Was he a fan of your books? Is that how he came to be in those movies?
Well, Paul was not only a fan of my books, he's also a fan of writers and the written word. I mean, he was, I wasn't the only writer who had a great relationship with Paul.
Yeah.
It sounds like boasting. I don't mean it to, but there was something about, my characters. I think I had a similar attitude towards my characters as he had, towards the characters, the people that he admired most in life. And I think my kind of rogue males, the character of Sully, who has kind of walked away from his family and then kind of walks back into it in the middle, finds himself in the middle of his family life again, and then Max Roby in Empire Falls, who essentially does the same thing. These rogue males, were people that Paul understood very well.
Right.
He understood that that character, why a man does a thing like that. He understood those characters very well. He understood the impulse to flee. He understood the impulse to return.
Yeah.
He understood the impulse to maintain one's freedom, even as you're going about tying yourself down in other ways. I think he understood that in a way that not every actor does.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the bond, I think, between. All those characters he played, and the two that came from my novels, but also the character in the movie Twilight that we did with that was yet another rogue male who's busy running away from home and family, even as he's looking for the next family that he can join.
Now that movie Twilight came out how long ago?
Well, it's not to be confused with the vampire
right.
Twilight.
That's out, right?
It's no, out
that's,
no,
that's
that was,
what I wanted to
that
clarify.
That was a good. That was a good what? Dozen years ago now, at least
okay.
maybe 15. God,
yeah, I came across mention of that as I was researching this interview, but I have not seen it, so I'll have to Netflix that one.
Oh, Netflix that one. It holds up very nicely, and there's strong performances in it all the way through. I'm not sure how well it works as a detective movie, but as a character study, it holds up very, very well, I think.
Yeah, great. What writers have influenced you? You mentioned Steinbeck, but I wonder other writers that might have had influence, either personally or through their works.
Through their works, Twain, of course, was enormously important to me even before I knew I was going to be a writer. I think it was through Twain that I understood that in order to go to the darkest places that a writer can go, you'd better go armed with humor, especially if you want readers to follow you.
Yeah.
Huckleberry Finn is probably the darkest of American novels, and you don't notice it because you're laughing. But it is about ignorance and racism and violence and all those things that are inherent in the American character that we don't like to admit. So Twain and of course Dickens, with the way he populated his novels with minor characters that were every bit as vivid as the major characters.
Uh-huh.
I think that's particularly true about that old Cape Magic. I think that the minor characters who come onto the scene, Marguerite steals every scene that she's in.
Yeah.
In the book, I think, and idiot twins from Joy's family, Harve, her heartbroken father. I think all of those things were things that I learned from Dickens.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, when I was writing, after the point where I learned that I wanted to be a writer, nobody was doing the kind of work that I wanted to do, except for just a very few people, among whom Richard Yates was to me the most important.
Mm.
He was writing about the kind of people that I wanted to write about. And he was writing it in the kind of very traditional fiction that at that time was kind of out of vogue. And so he was tremendously important to me.
Yeah, and I remember reading a quote by Vonnegut that Richard Yates was sort of exceptionally undernoticed, you know, at the time that he was writing.
Yeah, yeah.
He should have had a much larger audience for his times, that he was such a fabulous writer.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So my last question for you, Rick, is what advice do you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Oh, I wish I had really good, concrete advice, partly because of the fact that when I started writing, I was always stealing time. When I first started writing seriously, I was also a teacher, and so I would steal... an hour. I would run off. I would leave my office because students would always find me in my office. I would run to the cafeteria and find a table that faced the wall.
Yeah.
And I would wolf a hamburger and then have, 45 or 50 minutes to write furiously as much as I could on whatever novel I was working on. So I was always stealing time, and there wasn't enough of it, and I would just, pick up where I was yesterday and just write. And it was horrible at the time because I didn't have enough time to write, but it got me into a frame of mind where whenever I sat down, I could just write the next sentence, and if it was a crappy sentence, I'd never worry about it. I didn't have time to worry about it because I had to write the sentence after that. And it was excellent training. mm-hmm. for a writer, because I can honestly say that I have never had a moment of writer's block, and part of it has to do with a frame of mind that I think is very valuable for a writer to get into, and that is just not to care if you're writing badly.
Yeah.
It honestly doesn't bother me. What would bother me tremendously is not writing at all.
Mm-hmm.
So my attitude always is, write the sentence. If it's ugly, if it's untrue, if it's any of those things that make for bad writing, then just fix it later. But don't worry about it now. Just write it. And figure somehow in your mind, you have to convince yourself that anything that's wrong can be fixed later on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I believe that, and it's always been true for me. But I different writers are different in terms of their character and personality. And what works for me, I can tell you what works for me, but that doesn't mean it's going to work for somebody else.
Right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. This is great, and good luck with the book.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to Vermont.
And he did come to Vermont and had a very successful reading that next Friday. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Richard Russo. Next week, tune in to hear a conversation with Vermont author Jay Perini, whose forthcoming book, due out November 2nd, is a novel about Herman Melville. And the title of that is The Passages of H.M. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business. Located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the week. Bear Pond Books in Montpelier presents Tim Simard, author of Haunted Hikes of Vermont, Tuesday, October 26th at 7. The Flying Pig Bookstore in Shelburne presents Lori Halse Anderson, author of Forge, Wednesday, October 27th at 4. More information is available at 985-3999 or flyingpigevents@gmail.com. And I understand that Lori Halse Anderson will only be at the Flying Pig that evening or that afternoon for 1 hour exactly. She has to catch a plane, so you should know that. The Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center presents Michael Sabbath, author of The Good, the Bad, and the Difference, How to Talk to Children About Values, Thursday, October 28th at 7. The Flying Pig then presents Spooky Stories with Elizabeth and Josie, Friday, October 29th from 4:30 to 6. Elizabeth and Josie, the owners of The Flying Pig, will start out with mildly spooky stuff for younger children, and the stories will get scarier as the afternoon progresses. The entire event is for children ages 5 to teenage years, and more information is available at 985-3999 or flyingpigevents@gmail.com. The Northshire Bookstore presents Melissa Orlov, author of The ADHD Effect on Marriage. That's Friday, October 29th at 7. And then on October 30th at 7, the Northshire Bookstore will present Christopher Kimball, author of Fanny's Last Supper. The South Burlington Community Library continues its Brown Bag Lunch Series on Wednesday, October 27th at noon. Local author Pat Allen will speak about her book, Hands in the Earth, Lessons from My Father, a childhood memoir of growing up on a dairy farm in Vermont in the 1950s. That's October 27th at noon at the South Burlington Community Library. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the subject matter of Richard Russo's novel, That Old Cape Magic. Write about a childhood vacation. This can be a recollected vacation from when you were a child or an imagined vacation seen through the eyes of a fictional child. As you write, do focus on details of place. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of the show are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. Any comments about the show or suggestions about book-related events or writing prompts, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you send me a writing prompt, I will happily credit you for it. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby will bring you the world of music at 3 o'clock. We're finishing a little bit early today because my interview with Richard Russo last year was a short one. He had just about a half an hour, a little over half an hour, to speak on the phone. And so we have a little bit of a short show, but it was a great interview, so I hope you enjoyed it. So we'll put some music on until Cheryl gets here, and thank you for listening. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.